watch it. I'll say
that. That's what Steve said too, yeah.
Malcolm Woodward.
Oh, see, I'm not friends with him.
Yeah.
And I found out that
Morris
is
every
year.
She heard your
one day close for the tournament.
Well, good evening, everybody. So apparently Mark and I have got way off track. And Kelly. Yeah. Okay, I've gotten way off track. I think initially we were supposed to do two chapters a class. Because it worked out perfectly, 42 chapters and 24 classes. And then Kelly apparently told Mark, are you guys plan on finishing the class? And I hadn't even thought about it at all.
So make it sound so bad the way it
is. So we're like way behind. So in order to catch up, we're going to have to do like four chapters a class for maybe three weeks. And then the last class, we're going to have just a few chapters. But anyway, that's probably not a bad thing anyway, just because I feel like we've hit the main theme of the book, and that we've discussed the same kind of theme over and over and over. You guys have the general idea. So I think what we'll do, I don't want to neglect reading the books, the chapters, because these four chapters I'm going to do tonight are pretty self-explanatory. So we'll read through them. Any comments you guys have or whatever, we'll let it take some comments, and then I'll have a few comments, and then we'll just keep moving. If there's something we want to discuss, don't feel like we can't discuss something, but I feel like that, you know, when we get into this middle section, maybe we'll spend some more time when we get into God addressing Job. But again, these are just the discussions between his friends and Job, and the tension's just been building, and it's just been a back and forth, and a Job feeling optimistic or hopeful at some point, and then the despair drops out, the bottom drops out from under him, and he feels in despair. It's just up and down and back and forth with his friends through all these middle chapters. So, Kelly, do you mind starting us with a quick prayer?
Sure. Hey, Lord, thank you for this day and for all the blessings that you give to each and every one of us and for everyone in this room and putting priority to coming here tonight to learn about your word. Thank you for our families and pray that we have a good study tonight and listen and learn in Jesus' name, amen.
Amen. All right, so I'll read chapter 16, and like I said, I actually have 15 pages of notes, but if I make like one or two comments per chapter, we'll probably have to keep moving. All right, chapter 16. Then Job answered and said, I have heard many such things. Miserable comforters are you all. Shall windy words have an end? Or what provokes you that you answer? I also could speak as you, if you were in my place. I could join words together against you and shake my head at you. I could strengthen you with my mouth, and the solace of my lips would assuage your pain. If I speak, my pain is not assuaged, and if I forbear, how much of it leaves me? Surely now God has worn me out and has made me desolate, all my company, and he has shriveled me up, which is a witness against me, and my leanness has risen up against me. It testifies to my face. He has torn me in his wrath and hated me. He has gnashed his teeth at me. My adversary sharpens his eyes against me. Men have gapped at me with their mouth and have struck me insolently on the cheek. They mass themselves together against me. God gives me to the ungodly and casts me into the hands of the wicked. I was at ease and he broke me apart. He seized me by the neck and dashed me to pieces. He set me up as his target. His archers surround me. He slashes open my kidneys and does not spare. He pours out my gall on the ground. He breaks me with the breach upon breach. He runs upon me like a warrior. I have sewed sackcloth upon my skin, and I have laid my strength in the dust. My face is red with weeping, and my eyelids in deep darkness. Although there is no violence in my hands, and my prayer is pure. O earth, cover not my blood, and let not my cry find no resting place. Even now, behold, my witness is in heaven, and he who testifies for me is on high. My friends scorn me. My eye pours out tears against me, that he would argue the case of a man with God, as the Son of Man does with his neighbor. For a few years have come, and I shall go away, from which I shall not return. So he's answering Eliphaz's second speech, I think, here, and rebuttal to him through chapter 16 and 17. It starts off again, same as the last few chapters. Your words are misery to me. There's no comfort to them at all. It's a little bit different here. After he says that, he kind of puts himself in their position and says, I wouldn't do this to you. Thinking, he's kind of self-reflecting, what would I do if I were in their position and they were in my position? Would I treat them this way? And he's confident that he would not treat them that way. He said, I could strengthen you, or if you were in my place, I could join words together against you and shake my head at you. I could strengthen you with my mouth and the solace of my lips. But he says that he wouldn't do that. But then he reflects on himself again in verse 6 and talks about that no matter what I say, if I say this or if I do this, nothing eases the pain. And then he launches into 7 through 15, I guess, just an assault on God and what God has done to him. And it gets pretty graphic, more graphic than it has in any other chapter, talking about him cutting open his kidneys and spilling his gall on the ground. He breaks me and comes on him like a warrior. In verse 15, in the first chapter, or the first introduction, we talked about Job weeping with sackcloth and sitting in ashes. But he goes further here and says that he sewed sackcloth upon my skin. I guess making the point that this misery has just become a part of him, that it's so intense and such a part of his day in, day out life that he feels like it's sewed to his skin and that he can't get away from it. His face is red with weeping and his eyelids are dark in deep darkness. But then in 17, again, he holds firm to his innocence. There's no violence in my hand and my prayer is pure. And that was one of the accusations that several of the friends had made to him, that he hadn't addressed God directly. But here he talks about that he has prayed. He says his prayers are pure. I mean, he's trying to speak to God, but God's not answering his prayers. So then in the last part of the chapter, he talks about he's looking for someone to find a witness that the earth could witness, be verified that he's innocent. And then he's like, but if the earth could, but surely God knows that I'm innocent and he could argue the case for me. And then the last verse, the bottom drops out from underneath him again and he falls back into despair, wishing for death. And that's what leads into chapter 17. He says, for when a few years have come, I shall go away, from which I shall not return. And one thing that I was kind of thinking about, how repetitive this book has become, and that just the same general ideas, chapter after chapter after chapter, the back and forth between the friends. And I got thinking about, maybe, you know, it's possible that that it was written this way purposefully, because if you think about that's how Job felt, day after day after day, this repetitive nature of this, there's no end in sight to what I have to endure, kind of like what you guys have had to go through with me and her, talking about the same things week after week. But I just think it's interesting that the parallel between the theme, one of the themes of the book is just the endless repetitive nature of what he suffered day after day after day. And then each chapter is pretty much the same thing for us to go through and read it and try to understand what he endured. I know that was really fast for chapter 16, but any comments? Like I said, I feel like these four chapters, there was nothing in there that wasn't pretty self-explanatory based on kind of our ideas of what we gathered from the theme of the book.
So I guess is this like the first time he kind of pushes back, really, like, you're not helping me. Your words are I guess not really, but...
He said it multiple times to his friend, but each chapter he gets more and more...
Direct, I guess.
Yeah, and I feel like, you know, at first you get the idea that the friends are kind of just sitting around the table and they're discussing things. Now I feel like they're angry at each other. Job's angry at his friends, they're angry at him, and, I mean, if you could visualize this, I feel like they're probably... You know, this is probably loud voices. They're hollering at each other, these accusations, and, you know, that they're angry with each other at this point. And I feel like Job, each chapter, when he has to address them, he's more fed up with them, and he's more aggressive in his words. Any other comments?
Just seems like verse 19 sticks out quite a bit in this chapter. Even now, behold, my witness is in heaven, and he that voucheth for me is on high. So he talks about an umpire or a mediator. He goes back that God doesn't make junk, and he made me in his image. And I've had a relationship with him before, so there's value to that. He just goes back and reiterates, you know, it's up and down, but he reiterates. He does have hope. It's just slowly building, and he's having to kind of study or talk himself into it, but he's building hope.
Each chapter, I feel like, through all of his despair and all of his comments and anger, each chapter there's at least a verse or several verses where he sees through the darkness and sees through the clouds. And in chapter, when we get to chapter 19, we all know the verse where he talks about he knows that he has a Redeemer, and we sing the song, I know that my Redeemer lives. I mean, he holds fast to this idea. And in fact, I don't remember what chapter it is, but one of these chapters tonight, he talks about that through this, he knows he's being strengthened, and that whatever you're going to throw at me, I'm gonna stand my ground with God, and it strengthens me. So, Mark, do you mind reading chapter 17?
Mr. Brian.
Oh, yeah, go ahead.
Well, that second verse where he says, you're miserable comforters, I feel like these chapters kind of that he's all by himself. He's not getting any comfort from his friends, and they're not showing any empathy towards him. You know, they're not saying things like, you know, we're here for you, and he's just alone.
Yeah, and he addresses that, I think, in chapter 18, that he's complete, everything's been taken from him. He's completely alone. One of these verses here. And Kelly had made the point several times that he feels like that the friends were an actual a part of the torment, and we've seen that that's the case. And Job actually says that here, I think in the next chapter, but he said, in verse 10, he said, it sounds like he's saying, men have gapped with their mouth at me, just the general public. They have struck me instantly on the cheek, and they massed themselves together against me. I mean, that's kind of a direct assault at them, too. I mean, he's saying, you guys have massed yourselves against me when you're supposed to be here as my friends and my comforter. And he makes that argument through the next couple chapters several different times, talking directly about them and what he feels like they're doing to him.
Verse 22.
Yeah, my friends scorn me.
His friends aren't comforters.
No.
And that's not their plan. You know, although a lot of their plan is through Satan, I do think that their plan is to straighten him out with God rather than comfort him. As we've said before, they brought no oil to help him. They brought him no food. They brought him no new clothes. They didn't comfort anything in his physical realm. They were after his spiritual help. And they get more and more aggressive about that. There is no comfort on
their end. And to that point, before Mark reads chapter 17, in verse 4 of chapter 17, it says, since you have closed their hearts to understanding, therefore you will not let them triumph. And in verse 5, it says, he informs his friends to get a share of their property, their eyes of their children will fail. Verse 5, there was several different kind of, I felt like, weird commentators about that verse, but I think in verse 4 he's talking about his friends, that God has closed their hearts to understanding what I'm going through. I mean, it's part, like Kelly mentioned, it's part of his enduring this, is that his friends are not the comforters that they're supposed to be. All right, chapter 17, Mark, do you mind reading that?
My spirit is broken. My days are extinguished. The grave is ready for me. Surely mockers are with me, and my eye gazes on their provocation. Lay down now a pledge for me with thyself. Who is there that will be my guarantor? For thou hast kept their heart from understanding, therefore thou wilt not exalt them. He who informs against friends for a share of the spoil, the eyes of his children also shall languish. But he has made me a byword of the people. I am one at whom men spit. My eye has also grown dim because of grief, and all my members are as a shadow. The upright shall be appalled at this, and the innocent shall stir up himself against the godless. Nevertheless, the righteous shall hold his way, and he who has clean hands shall grow stronger and stronger. But come again, all of you now, for I do not find a wise man among you. My days are past, my plans are torn apart, even the wishes of my heart. They make night into day, saying, the light is near, in the presence of darkness. If I look for Sheol as my home, I make my bed in the darkness. If I call to the pit, you are my father, to the worm, my mother, my sister. Where now is my hope? And who regards my hope? Will it go down with me to Sheol? Shall we together go down into the dust?
So, I mean, you guys can see he's getting more aggressive in his word choices to his friends here. But he also seems to be falling further and further down this pit, basically embracing death if it would come to him, saying that I hope for Sheol as my home. I guess, care if I turn the fan on? So he's just in this miserable state. I mean, he starts, my spirit is broken, my days are extinct, the graveyard is ready for me. I mean, he's wishing for death, but as Mark's talked about several times, he's not gonna inflict that on himself. He's gonna stick it out, because there's points even in this chapter where he feels like he wishes for death, but he knows that there's some hope. In verse 9, yet the righteous holds to his way, and he who has clean hands grows stronger and stronger. He knows that he has clean hands, and he knows that he's right, that he's righteous. And he's going to hold to that. No matter how he wishes for death, there's still a glimmer of hope that he's going to hang on to. And that's what gets him through it. I think there's a great lesson for us in that. I mean, obviously none of us have endured anything like this, but the trials that we face, there's always hope. And God always provides hope for us. And he always provides a listening ear for us to pray to and to bring our concerns to him and to put our trust and faith in him, for him to give us the strength that we need to make it. And I mean, there's no better lesson in the entire Bible about someone that endured and kept strong. He calls his friends in verse 2 mockers, and their eyes dwell with provocation. What I was talking about in verse 5, that his he who informs against his friends to get a share of their property, the eyes of his children will fail. I don't know if I agree with this or not, but it's interesting. At least some commentators talked about that these friends, they actually saw Job as right on the verge of death. And they thought, you know, his children are gone, he has no inheritance, or no one to inherit anything. But he still had property, he still had, apparently his home was still standing. And in verse chapter 18, it talks about his wife is still around, it says that. So these commentators were implying that maybe they were wishing for his death so that they could take possession of his property. They could get a share of what's his, what was left over when he's gone. They were hanging out to just torment him until he finally passes. And then, you know, it's like someone sweeping in to clean up what's left after something's gone, you know what I mean? Like scavengers. And then in verse 6, he talks about that God has made him a byword to the people, that people spit at his direction. His eyes grown dim from vexation. The people are appalled at him. The innocent stirs up himself against the godless. And again, another kind of jab to him in verse 10, and I shall not find a wise man among you. He keeps taking his shots. You know, they take their shots at him, he takes his shots right back at them. He calls them beasts or cattle or something. Maybe it's in the next chapter. But he ends the chapter again, hoping for a bed in darkness, saying to the pit, you are my father, to the worm, my mother, or my sister, and I shall go down to the bars of Sheol. Shall we descend together into the dust? Falling into a pit of despair again. But 18 comes along, and he's got Bildad to cheer him up. Chapter 18. Any comments on 17? How long will you hunt for words? Consider, and then we will speak. Why are we counted as cattle? Why are we stupid in your sight? You who tear yourself in your anger, shall the earth be forsaken for you, or the rock be removed out of its place? Indeed, the light of the wicked is put out, and the flame of the fire does not shine. The light is the dark in his tent, and his lamp above him is put out. His strong steps are shortened, and his own schemes throw him down. For he is cast into a net by his own feet, and he walks on its mesh. A trap seizes him by the heel, a snare lays a hold of him. A rope is hidden for him in the ground, a trap for him in the path. Terrors frighten him on every side and chase him at his heels. His strength is famished, and covering is ready for his stumbling. It consumes the parts of his skin. The firstborn of death consumes his limbs. He is torn from the tent in which he trusted, and he is brought to the king of terrors. In his tent dwells that which is none of his. Sulfur is scattered over his habitation. His roots dry up beneath, and his branches wither above. His memory perishes from the earth, and he has no name in the street. He is thrust from light into darkness and driven out of the world, and he has no posterity or progeny among his people, and no survivor where he used to live. They are of the west, and they are appalled at his day, and horror seized them to the east. Surely such are the dwellings of the unrighteous, such is the place of him who knows not God. I think Bildad has ramped it up in this chapter too. I think that all of the friends, Eliphaz started out, you know, maybe one or two kind of pointed lines in the first chapter, and then every chapter progressively gets more and more aggressive. And I think this is the most aggressive of all of them. I mean, he, right out of the gate, how long will you hunt for words? But basically, he is not only elevating his wisdom over Job, but I feel like he feels like he's elevating his wisdom over his other friends here as well. He's saying, how long will you hunt for words? Consider, and then we will speak. So he's basically saying, when you get your act together and come around to confessing, then you can come and talk to me, because I have the answers. You consider me as cattle, and why are we stupid in your sight? I mean, you can tell they're angry now at this point that Job has made his comments to them, that they're worthless, there's no value in anything that they say to him, and why are we stupid in your sight? He's basically said, you're the one sitting here in the ash heap scraping yourself, and you call us cattle, and we're stupid? I mean, think about how kind that is to someone that's suffering like this, to just be like, you're the one that's sitting here, you know, in outside of town, lost everything, scraping the boils, and you're calling us stupid, and you who tear yourself in anger, shall the earth be forsaken for you, or the rock be removed out of its place? He's very aggressive in his comments to Job. After Job, at the very end of this, is basically wishing for death, and he comes on this strong, aggressively talking about that he considers them stupid. He talks about, and then
Go ahead. I don't know if he calls them stupid, but when he refers to, my understanding of this, when he refers to them as beasts, just like beasts have, they don't have a soul, they're not made in the image of God, and God has hid from them things that would affect their heart or conscience, they're acting like a beast, something that doesn't have any conscience, that doesn't have a soul, that's and because what they're doing is they're just hanging their hat on what they've been told and what they've always known. And he's trying to explore and trace down these lines of thought of why he's being treated the way he is and why things are happening, why. And they just keep going back to the old, you know, look at you, you're in sin, it's obvious, you know. And they're just not, they're closed-minded. He can't convince them, and they are not willing to listen.
Yeah, I mean,
and yet both of them are speaking some truth, but not complete.
Right, Mom?
I kind of get the feeling that all his friends are kind of self-righteous too, that, you know, we're the ones that haven't sinned, and we're, you know, we're right here, and you're not.
Yeah, absolutely. I definitely think that. Okay.
Back to the phrase where he says, "Why are we stupid in your sight?" It's kind of like, have you ever had a conversation with someone about, maybe hard conversation about something, and then they repeat back to you kind of what they felt, and it was nothing like what you meant? How did you get that? Have you ever had a conversation with someone about that? No, I didn't say that you were inept at your job. I just said I want you to be here on time, for example. I take it in this is when they heard Job talk, they're listening, but they're not hearing. What they heard was, you all are stupid. And that's why he says this. Why are we stupid in your sight?
Right.
This whole 18th chapter reminds me a whole lot of a first grade playground fight. Job is talking, and it looks like he's sitting there. Bildad's like, well, oh yeah? Well, you know, he just jumps right back at him like that. But the biggest cut of all is the last one. Surely such are the dwellings of the unrighteous, such is the place of him who knows not God. He's basically saying, God has nothing to do with you. And I'm not quite sure what else he could say that would be more debilitating or worse.
Yeah, I was leading up to that. That's in verse 21. That he ends the chapter just basically saying, you act like you know God and you act like you're righteous and innocent, but you don't even know God. But it's also saying that they do know God. They do know what God, how God operates, and that they have all the answers, which they don't. Job doesn't either, but he's working through that at a better pace than they are. I think in verse 8 through 12 or 10, 11, I guess, talks about him sees a trap seized by the heel, and a snare lays a hold of him, a rope is hidden for him, a trap for him in his path. Brayden and I just watched, or Andrew, we just watched Swiss Family Robinson the other night. That little kid digs pits and covers them up and tries to catch tigers and stuff. I feel like that's what they're accusing, that they're saying that God does to Job, because of Job's sin, that God has set these snares and these traps for him to catch him and constantly takes hold of him and is punishing for him for his sin. So the wicked man tries, he's going to get caught every time. That no matter what he does, if you're in sin like you are, Job, there's going to be a snare, there's going to be a trap, you're going to trip yourself up, you'll eventually get caught. And because you're in this situation, obviously, I mean, he's trying to build case and evidence, bring evidence that because you've been caught in these traps and snares, these traps, it's proof that you're in sin. You wouldn't be where you're at if you weren't in sin. Let's see. And then, they go back in verse 16 and 17, several different times in the various previous chapters. There's been imagery from nature. His roots dry up underneath, and his branches wither above. just the poetic imagery we've discussed several times. And like Kelly said in verse 21, he stuck the knife in deep here. Surely such are the dwellings of the unrighteous. Such is the place of him who knows not God. I mean, he's taking his last and final shot. You're not righteous. You're unrighteous. And you know not God. And then that leads into chapter 19 and Job's response to that. He starts off, how long will you torment me and break me in pieces with your words? And I don't know, in verse 3 of chapter 19 it says, these 10 times you have cast reproach upon me, you are not ashamed to wrong me. I don't know if there's some dialogue that's not recorded, because their speeches don't add up to 10, but whatever that means. Or maybe he's just saying that this number of times that you've verbally assaulted me and cast your words on me, however many times it's been. But I think it's interesting. Are you not ashamed to wrong me? I mean, he's asking them, does it not bother you to see me in this state and to cast hot coals on me further, to torment me further? Does that not bother you to see me, to hurt me like this? You were my friends. And then in verse 4, or I guess I'll go ahead and read it and then we'll go back. And even if it be true that I have erred, my error remains with myself. And if indeed you magnify yourselves against me and make my disgrace an argument against me, know then that God has put me in the wrong and closed his net about me. Behold, I cry out violence, but I am not answered. I call for help, but there is no justice. He has walled up my way so that I cannot pass, and he has set darkness upon my paths. He has stripped me from glory and taken the crown from my head. He breaks me down on every side and I am gone. And my hope, he has pulled up like a tree. He has kindled his wrath against me and counts me as his adversary. His troops come on together and they have cast up their siege ramps against me and encamp around my tent. He has put my brothers far from me, and those who knew me are wholly estranged from me. My relatives have failed me. My close friends have forgotten me. The guests in my house and my maidservants count me as a stranger, and I have become a foreigner in their eyes. I call to my servant, but he gives me no answer. I must plead with him in my mouth for mercy, with my mouth for mercy. My breath is strange to my wife, and I am a stench to the children of my own mother. Even young children despise me, and when I rise, they talk against me. All my intimate friends abhor me, and those whom I love have turned against me. My bones stick to my skin and to my flesh, and I have escaped by the skin of my teeth. Have mercy on me, O you my friends, for the hand of God has touched me. Why do you, like God, pursue me? Why are you not satisfied with my flesh? Oh, that my words were written. Oh, that they were inscribed in a book. Oh, that with an iron pen and lead they were engraved in the rock forever. For I know that my Redeemer lives, and at the last he will stand upon the earth. And after my skin has been destroyed, yet in my flesh I shall see God, whom I shall see forever. And my eyes shall behold, and not another. My heart faints within me. If you say, how will we pursue him, and the root of the matter is found in him, be afraid of the sword. For wrath brings the punishment of the sword, that you may know that there is a judgment. So in verse 4 he says, even if I have sinned, that's my business. And for you to continue just assaulting me like this, it's not making the situation any better. That, you know, they're not trying to help him in any way. And then he goes into this section, and I think this is what you were talking about, Mom, that he's just completely alone. I mean, the friends aren't his friends. Well, first he talks about how he feels like what God has done to him. He has walled up my way that I cannot pass. He has set darkness on my path. He has stripped me from glory and taken my crown from my head. He breaks me down on every side and I am gone. And my hope has pulled up like a tree. Kindles his wrath against me and counts me as his adversary. It's one thing for Job to say that God considers him an adversary and to feel that in his heart, but is it different when his friend in the last part of chapter 18 basically essentially says the same thing? You see what I'm saying? Like, if Kelly tells me that, it doesn't come as good as if I think it, right? Like, if you say you don't know God, God's your adversary, but I feel in my heart God is my adversary, it's different.
Possible. I mean, I think if it was you and Kelly, you know, it might be different than what we're getting here, though. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I mean, because you trust what Kelly has to say, if he has something to come to you. You know, I mean, because we don't need to be like... We need to make sure that if I have an issue with you, I come to you, and because you know I'm your friend, you're going to take it good. But like in this instance, you know, he knows that he hasn't done anything wrong. You know, and they keep pounding on him, you know. So, you know what I'm saying? I mean,
yeah. I guess my point is that I feel like that for someone to internally feel that God, because of the circumstances he's in, for me to say, if I was Job, for me to say, God is my adversary, I may say that and think that because of the circumstances,
right.
But I feel like that may just be a tactic to deal with the situation. But when a friend accuses you of that, there's a different. That's a different scenario, I feel like. But I understand what you're saying.
Yeah.
Does that make any sense, or did I just...
We're on the same page, so yeah. We're good.
Well, and Jason and I were talking before class. He's like, I wouldn't keep these friends around. I don't know why he just doesn't send them on their way. He keeps going, having this discussion with them back and forth. He says that, and you magnify yourselves against me and make my disgrace an argument against me. I mean, it's like they enjoy. They seem to enjoy. It's like they're not, like you said, Mark, they're not going to stop until they can get the answer that they want out of him. All you got to do is say these words, I sin, and then this will be better for you. It'll all be over. And then in verses 13 through 19, this is addressing what you were talking about, Mom, that he's just completely alone in this situation, that anyone who knew him previous to this is gone. His servants, even though they're apparently still around, they count him as a stranger. And apparently in verse 17, we had discussed earlier what may have possibly happened to his wife, that she's apparently still here. He says that even my breath is a stranger to my wife. So I don't know if he's apparently not, didn't say, I'd have to go back and look, but in the first or second chapter, didn't say that he was basically living outside of town in the refuge of the town dump, basically.
He's living away from his house, yeah, somewhere at a place cast out.
Right, so she may still be at their house because their house wasn't destroyed, the kids' houses was. So she's apparently still around, but is a stranger to Job. I'm a stench to the children of my own mother, so apparently he has brothers or sisters that are still around that can, you know, are having nothing to do with him. Young children despise him. His intimate friends, and this may be a shot at his friends that are right here in front of his face. My intimate friends abhor me, and those whom I love have turned against me. And I think that's interesting that he says, those who I love who turn against me, and then leading into verse 21, he repeats twice, have mercy on me, have mercy on me. You guys were my friends and I loved you. Please have mercy on me. For the hand of God has touched me. I mean, he's at the lowest point in his life, trying to figure out why he's in this situation, and he's begging his friends to have mercy on him. I want to take the last 5 or 6 minutes here to talk about verses 25 to 27.
One thing.
Yeah, go ahead.
One thing, as far as from a reader standpoint, I think that this dialogue that they have here is for multiple reasons. But one thing we have to remember is Job 1 and Job 2 was a long time ago. 19, 18 chapters ago. And as a reader, you may forget a little bit about where we are with the back and forth, and I'm good, no you're not, I'm good, no you're not. All you have to do is reread through this chapter, and you're brought right up to speed with where Job is. And I think it's good as a reader to be able to read again, oh yeah, he's stripped from my glory. He breaks me down on every side. His wrath is kindled against me. He has put my brothers far from me. My relatives have failed me. I've become a foreigner in their eyes. I call my servant. I don't have one. My breath has estranged my wife. He paints his story again to re-remind us, because I think sometimes you could read so long we become numb to the fact of where he is. And by having this here, reading it, it brings you all back to, oh yeah, this is a really bad, epic situation he's in right here, moving forward.
Yeah. So, Kelly, you read 25 through 27.
For I know that my Redeemer lives, and at the last he will stand upon the earth. And after my skin has been thus destroyed, yet in my flesh I shall see God, whom I shall see for myself, and my eyes shall behold, and not another. My heart faints within me. If you say, how will we pursue him? And the root of the matter is found in him. Be afraid of the sword, for wrath brings the punishment of the sword, that you may know there is a judgment.
So when you guys read 25 through 27, what does that bring to mind?
Jesus.
Yeah, I think so too. We'll go ahead, Ron.
His faith surfaces that after all this stuff he's been through, he's at the very end of his ropes. And these powerful words, what he says.
Yeah, but I think it's also a pretty powerful foreshadowing of Jesus and the resurrection.
Oh, yes.
Mm-hmm. And what you said, Ron, that he's reached the end of his rope, but there's still that hope he's clinging on to, that he knows that his Redeemer lives, that God is the Redeemer. And fast forward that all the way to the time of Jesus and up to us, that he was our Redeemer. And he will return to earth. And after my skin has been destroyed, after we die, are we resurrected to a new body? Yet in my flesh I will see God. We're resurrected to a new body with God. I just think it's a powerful foreshadowing of the Redeemer and the resurrection that he and did on our behalf. Anybody have any other thoughts or comments on that?
Well, I was thinking too that in some way, Job also is a kind of a, is like Jesus, that his friends forsook him, the apostles, disciples all forsook him, and he suffered physically when he was being crucified. So that the same as Job had those, and he was mocked, just like Job is being mocked by his friends.
Yeah, there's lots of similarities that you can make comparisons between the situation Job endured and what Jesus endured in his life.
And he reflects, or not reflects, but he basically is coming to a conclusion that there will be a judgment as well. He will have a day in court. He will have the ability at some point to plead this case.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, he may not get the answer here and to get his point or his point of view that, or his plead his case of innocence accomplished here, but you're right, and at some point we'll all have that opportunity, and we're either prepared for it or we're not.
And that, to go off of that, back in chapter 16, he talks about, surely even now my witness is in heaven and my evidence is on high.
Right.
So he knows that judgment is coming, and he knows that he is innocent, and God, he's innocent before God's eyes.
Yeah, absolutely. And if God could be right there as his advocate right now, he could attest to his innocence to his friends. The last verse, be afraid of the sword, for wrath brings the punishment of the sword, that you may know that there is a judgment. So, I don't know if he's speaking out of delirium here or whatever, saying that I'm going to bring the sword, so be afraid, or for the